Thank you to the organizers for this invitation to do the Astro Refresher course on lymphoma. Over the next hour, I hope to impart upon you that we as radiation oncologists still play a key role in the management of patients with lymphoma. I'll review indications for radiation for both classical and non-classical Hodgkin's lymphoma, in addition to the non-Hodgkin's lymphomas DLBCL, follicular lymphoma, and extranodal marginal zone lymphoma. We'll also review data for how radiation for patients with lymphoma interfaces with systemic therapy and diagnostic imaging, in particular PET. And then we'll also review strategies to minimize radiation toxicity, including the concept of involved node and site radiation and available advanced radiation techniques. So we'll start with classical Hodgkin's lymphoma. And as you can see outlined here, the role of radiation for Hodgkin's lymphoma spans both for early stage and advanced stage disease, and both in the upfront and relapse refractory setting. And contemporary trials really are aimed to evaluate the role of radiation in the PET era. The workup for a patient with Hodgkin lymphoma should include a history and physical with attention to systemic symptoms such as B symptoms. This includes unexplained fever, weight loss, more than 10% of the patient's body weight in the last 6 months, and drenching night sweats. An ESR should be obtained with in addition to the other labs, and consideration of pregnancy testing for females of childbearing age. For diagnostic staging, PET CT should be performed ideally, and if you can, IV contrast for the CAT scan. Sometimes, because patients have to start urgently, the PET cannot be obtained, but at a minimum, a CAT scan should be obtained for staging purposes. Additional workup for Hodgkin's lymphoma includes an ejection fraction and pulmonary function test for certain patients, given the risk of side effects from chemotherapy, and then discussion of fertility preservation, as many of these patients present in their second and third decade of life. Excisional biopsy is the standard of care. For pathology, there are two types of Hodgkin's lymphoma, classical and non-classical Hodgkin's lymphoma. These are very distinct pathologic and clinical entities. For classical Hodgkin's lymphoma, there are four subtypes: nodular sclerosing, mixed cellularity, lymphocyte rich, and lymphocyte depleted, and has an immunophenotype that is CD15 and 30 positive, negative for CD20 and 45. And this is in contrast to non-classical Hodgkin's lymphoma, where the immunophenotype is flipped, and this is also known as nodular lymphocyte predominant Hodgkin's lymphoma. For Hodgkin's and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, the staging and response assessment is as per the Lugano classification. So for staging, PET CT should be routinely used for lymphomas that are FDG avid, which include Hodgkin lymphoma, DLBCL, and even some indolent non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, including follicular lymphoma. In those lymphomas that are not FDG avid, a diagnostic CT scan should be obtained otherwise. Patients that undergo a PET CT for Hodgkin's or DLBCL actually do not require bone marrow biopsy anymore, and we don't use the designation of X for bulky. We report the longest measurement by CT. Response should be assessed using a PET CT scan for those that have FDG avid lymphomas, and this is standardly reported through the Deauville 5-point scale, which we'll talk about in the next slide. Even if patients have a CT residual but have a complete metabolic response based on PET, this is considered a complete response. And then once patients have finished treatment, surveillance imaging in the absence of symptoms or physical exam findings, it's discouraged for Hodgkin's and DLBCL. For Hodgkin lymphoma, given the high rate of cure, there's actually a high rate of false positives. And for DLBCL, there are suggestions that detection-based radiographically don't have different outcomes compared to detections based on clinical exam or symptoms. The Deauville 5-point score is used for response assessment, and this uses the most intense uptake in a site of initial disease and compares it to the patient's mediastinal and liver blood pools, and this is a visual assessment. So Deauville 1 is no uptake above background, Deauville 2 is uptake less than mediastinum, Deauville 3 is uptake greater than mediastinum but less than liver, Deauville 4 is moderately higher than liver, and Deauville 5 is markedly higher than liver and or new lesions. In clinical practice, a complete metabolic response is considered a Deauville 1 to 3, but of note, in those clinical trials in which they were testing safety of de-escalating treatment, a Deauville 3 would be considered positive. There are potential pitfalls with PET, namely that there can be other etiologies that cause uptake. This can include brown fat, which has a very classical distribution, including bilateral involvement of the neck and supraclavicular region, the periaortic and paravertebral region, as you can see here on these axial images on the right, and then suprarenal region. Sarcoidosis, which most commonly can affect the thorax, can also cause uptake in the lung and intrathoracic lymph nodes. The modified Ann Arbor staging is used for both patients with Hodgkin's and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Stage 1 is one nodal group, and if you had extranodal disease, it would be a single extranodal site without any nodal involvement. Stage 2 is two or more nodal groups on the same side of the diaphragm, and if there's extranodal involvement, this is limited and contiguous with the nodal involvement. Stage 3 is lymph nodes on both sides of the diaphragm, and stage 4 is additional non-contiguous extralymphatic involvement. Extralymphatic involvement can include involvement of the CSF, bone marrow, liver, and lungs. It notably does not include tonsils, Waldeyer's rings, or spleen. These are considered nodal tissue. And then the A versus B designation, referring to the presence or absence of B symptoms, is only for Hodgkin's lymphoma patients. What is bulky? Well, there's no agreed-upon definition, which is why we record the maximum tumor dimension on CT at staging. For Hodgkin's lymphoma, historically this has been 10 centimeters or greater than one-third the transthoracic diameter on a chest x-ray. 7 centimeters has actually been validated among patients getting chemotherapy alone to be prognostic. For DLBCL, there has been a suggested range, 6 to 10 centimeters, though in many recent clinical trials, the cutoff of 7.5 centimeters has been used. And then for follicular lymphoma, a suggested cutoff has been 6 centimeters. This brings us to our first SACME question. A 30-year-old female presents with progressive right neck fullness without any fevers, chills, night sweats, or weight loss. Staging workup demonstrates nodular sclerosing Hodgkin's lymphoma of the right neck and upper mediastinum, and her PET scan is shown here on the right. Her ESR is 8. Which of the following best describes the patient's clinical stage? The management of early-stage Hodgkin's lymphoma first rests on whether patients have favorable versus unfavorable disease, and the definition of unfavorable actually varies across different cooperative groups. Based on this table here, you can see that many of these groups do share commonalities in their definition, including an elevated ESR and a large mediastinal mass and increased number of nodal sites, but there can be other inclusions, including presence of extranodal disease or age, that can vary by group. It's also important to realize that lymph node grouping varies across study groups. So for example, the Ann Arbor lymph node regions counts mediastinum and the left and right hilar regions each as distinct nodal sites. So this would be 3 nodal groups involved, whereas the German Hodgkin study group actually lumps this all into one nodal station. So it's important to realize that lymph node regions are defined differently across study groups, and so you need to make sure you use the appropriate one if you're using that particular group's definition of favorable versus unfavorable. The management of early-stage favorable Hodgkin's lymphoma was defined by this landmark study by the German Hodgkin Study Group, HD10. In this study, they randomized patients with stage 1 to 2 without any of the 4 clinical risk factors, which included large mediastinal mass, extranodal disease, 3 or more nodal areas involved, and an elevated ESR. The premise of this study was that we understand that early-stage Hodgkin's lymphoma is often cured, but patients are living long enough to get the side effects of chemotherapy and or radiation. So the question is, can we safely de-escalate treatment for these patients? So in this 2x2 factorial non-inferiority design, they asked a question whether 2 cycles of ABVD is non-inferior to 4, and whether 20 gray is non-inferior to 30 gray. And both of the experimental arms were considered non-inferior, establishing 2 cycles of ABVD and 20 gray as standard of care. Not surprisingly, there was less toxicity with the de-escalated treatment, though in this study there was no functional imaging used and we were using involved field radiation. So for this patient, she underwent 2 cycles of ABVD and had a repeat PET CT, which you can see here on the right showed a Deauville 2 response. Our second live SACME question is, what is the recommended dose of radiation for a patient with early-stage favorable classical Hodgkin's lymphoma who attains a Deauville 2 response to 2 cycles of ABVD chemotherapy? The German Hodgkin Study Group HD16 has recently investigated this question. In this study, they took the same cohort that was investigated in the HD10 trials, so stage 1, 2 patients in the absence of those four clinical risk factors, and randomized them upfront to the standard of care, which, as you can see here on the top line, two cycles of ABVD, and regardless of the PET, they got 20 Gray Van Valfield. And then the other half were randomized to the experimental arm, which is based on the PET. It would dictate kind of what the next treatments would be. So they would get, if they had were complete metabolic response, omission of radiation, and if the PET was positive, 20 Gray Van Valfield. There were two main findings from this study. The first is that among patients that attained a complete metabolic response after two cycles of ABVD, omission of radiation, which is that red line on the left here, was not non-inferior to combined modality treatment. The 95% confidence interval actually exceeded the pre-specified non-inferiority margin of 10% at 5 years. So the first take-home is radiation cannot be safely omitted after a complete metabolic response to two cycles of ABVD. The second finding is that among patients that were PET negative and received radiation, and patients that were PET positive and received radiation, those patients that had a positive PET still had inferior progression-free survival by about 12%. So PET positivity indicates a high risk for treatment failure, and likely 20 Gray of radiation is inadequate therapy for these patients. What are the appropriate fields for our patients? Well, before I start talking about involved node and site radiation, I'd like to take one step back just to review the evolution of our radiation fields with respect to chemotherapy. So back in the 1960s, before there was very good chemotherapy, radiation was being used to treat not only gross disease, but all subclinical sites of disease as well, which is why we were using fields such as the mantle field and then the inverted Y, which would treat the periaortic and pelvic with or without the inguinal lymph nodes. ABVD came on the scene in the late 1980s and 1990s, and randomized trials demonstrated that we could safely de-escalate our fields to just treating the gross disease and more contiguous nodal regions. And then more recently, in the late 2000s, with the INRT-ISRT concept, the idea is that we're now leaving chemotherapy to treat all the subclinical disease, and radiation is only used to treat the initial extent of the GTV. So as I had alluded to, for the INRT-ISRT concept, your pre-chemotherapy GTV determines your CTV, allowing for modifications in anatomy. So to illustrate this concept, we have here on the panels these coronal images, and for panels A and B, in pink is outlined the pre-chemotherapy GTV. In panel C, you can see that the patient has had a really good response to chemotherapy, so there's shrinkage of the mediastinum. And if you were to overlay that pink pre-chemo GTV onto the radiation treatment plan, the portions of this contour would include organs at risk that were never involved at diagnosis. So this is modified accordingly in panel E. So ISRT allows for the fact that there can be a little bit of uncertainty in knowing exactly where that pre-chemotherapy GTV extent was, given changes or differences in the acquisition of a diagnostic CAT scan and your radiation treatment plan. So, for example, differences in the neck flexion or arms up versus down. INRT is a special case of ISRT in which optimal imaging is available. So, for example, in Europe, many patients get their diagnostic scans in the radiation treatment planning position, and therefore you can imagine that the fusion between the two is quite good, and you may feel more confident knowing where that initial GTV extent was. The second aspect of ISRT-INRT is that we're using now modern radiation techniques. We're using 3D treatment planning instead of using bony anatomy to delineate out our field borders. There is actually no randomized data comparing IFRT with ISRT-INRT, though there is prospective data in which INRT is used for the ERTC H10 study, which I'll talk about shortly. And there's actually retrospective data from British Columbia Cancer Agency looking at the progression-free survival and patterns of failure based on the fields used. As you can see here on the right, there's no significant difference in progression-free survival. And if you look at the patterns of recurrence, the local regional recurrences actually all occurred in the larger fields, and they were all in field without a marginal relapse. And then while efficacy probably is not significantly decreased with our smaller fields, we do anticipate that the late toxicity should significantly decrease. And this has been shown in both studies from the British Columbia Cancer Agency in the Netherlands, looking at the secondary breast cancer risk based on the size of fields, with lower risk with the smaller fields, IFRT, ISRT, INRT on the left here, and then mediastinal RT on the right here. So for this patient, I simulated her with her arms down. This brings less breast tissue in medially. I simulated her with IV contrast, infused it to her pre-chemotherapy PET-CT, and delineated out her ITV-CTV in this orange color here and the PTV in pink. And then we now have this toolkit of radiation techniques that we can customize and pick and choose for a particular patient and his or her anatomy. And this includes options for motion management, including deep inspiration breath hold versus 4D CT, radiation techniques, including 3D conformal IMRT, VMAT, and proton therapy, and then both KV and volumetric IGRT, which may allow us to shrink our PTV margins. So there are a variety of treatment techniques available for mediastinal lymphoma, which I'll illustrate in the next couple slides. In terms of motion management, there is the 4D CT, which I simulated her, and then also did a deep inspiration breath hold scan. The experience of DIBH is borrowed from patients with breast cancer, in which that deep inspiration pulls that heart down inferiorly, creating more space between the upper mediastinum and heart. It also maximally inflates the lungs so that you're reading a smaller volume of the lung, and it's obviously a form of motion management. For this patient, because her disease was exclusively upper mediastinum, there was a benefit in terms of heart sparing and also the lung metrics, as you can see here. And these findings are consistent with a larger retrospective study from the Institut Gustave Roussy. In this study, they simulated patients both with free breathing and then a deep inspiration breath hold scan, and found that those patients that derived the greatest benefit for the DIBH in terms of reduction in mean, coronary, and heart dose were those patients that had exclusively upper mediastinal involvement, defined here as the disease not lower than 3 centimeters below the carina. In terms of radiation techniques, there is the IMRT butterfly technique, which has been described by the MD Anderson group. And that butterfly shape comes in from the beam angles that are preferred for IMRT. So very steep anterior oblique and posterior oblique fields, basically trying to avoid more lateral beams that would be treating through more of the breast tissue. And then the other advanced technique to consider is proton therapy. We have protons at the University of Washington. And so I created a comparative plan on her free breathing scan with a proton plan using an AP or steep anterior oblique fields. And then compared this to her photon deep inspiration breath hold plan, which was APPA. And you can see here on the right on this table that the proton free breathing plan had the lowest heart and lung metrics. But this was actually quite comparable to the photon DIBH plan. The International Lymphoma Radiation Oncology Group, or ILROG, has published suggested acceptable doses to organs at risk in the mediastinum. And this may help guide consideration of when you may want to consider from a 3D to an advanced radiation technique, or even when you have an advanced radiation technique and are not necessarily able to meet these constraints, kind of reconsideration if radiation can be safely delivered. We'll move on to case 2 and transition from early stage favorable to early stage unfavorable Hodgkin's lymphoma. This is a 37-year-old female who presented with cough and a left neck mass. She was found to have nodular sclerosing Hodgkin's lymphoma of the left neck and mediastinum, and incidentally had brown fat activation on her PET CT scan, no B symptoms, and ESR of 25. Based on 2 nodal sites being involved, but that she had bulky disease of the mediastinum, she would be considered to have stage 2A early unfavorable disease. The role of radiation for bulky disease is supported by this Italian study. In this study, patients with 5 centimeters or greater of disease underwent 6 cycles of VEBEP chemotherapy, which is a more intensive chemotherapy compared to ABVD, and then were restaged with PET. Among patients that were PET negative, they were then randomized to observation or radiation to 32 gray with a boost. Of note, 2/3 of patients in this trial were stage 1-2 at randomization. And in this study, they found that the addition of radiation improved event-free survival by 10%. And if you look at the patterns of relapse, all the relapses in the observation arm were within the sites of bulk and contiguous nodal areas, and there was not a significant increase in acute toxicity with the addition of radiation. So this study really supports the benefit of radiation in patients with bulky Hodgkin's lymphoma. What dose should we use for patients with early stage unfavorable Hodgkin's lymphoma? Well, the German Hodgkin study group had evaluated whether dose could be de-escalated for favorable patients, and the answer was yes. And so they asked a similar question for unfavorable patients in the HD11. So in this study, they had early stage patients with unfavorable features, and they underwent a 2x2 factorial randomization. So the first question was chemotherapy, ABVD versus a more intensive chemotherapy known as Biocop. And then for the second randomization, whether 20 gray was considered non-inferior to 30 gray. So they found that Biocop plus 30 gray did not improve the freedom from treatment failure over ABVD plus 30 gray. You can see that the lines overlap here on the right, but that ABVD plus 20 gray, which is that yellow line here, had a worse freedom from treatment failure. This suggests that there's actually an interaction between chemotherapy and radiation. With Biocop, you can de-escalate from 30 to 20 gray, but you cannot do this safely with ABVD. So this established a standard of care for early stage unfavorable patients, 4 cycles of ABVD plus 30 gray of radiation. The next iteration of trials is now evaluating whether we can incorporate PET as part of what's called response-adapted therapy. We know that PET can be prognostic, and maybe it can identify those patients in which radiation can be omitted. So this is a very similar strategy for what was done in the German Hodgkin study group HD16. So both the UK RAPID and EORTC studies evaluated this response-adapted approach. Of note, the German Hodgkin study group also has an ongoing trial for patients with early unfavorable disease, which is called the HD17. So for the UK RAPID, patients received 3 cycles of ABVD, had a PET, and if they were negative, then randomized to the standard, which is radiation, versus the experimental arm, which is observation. For the EORTC study, they stratified patients upfront with favorable versus unfavorable disease, which would affect the number of chemotherapy cycles they got. And they were randomized upfront to the standard, which was regardless of the PET. All patients then received additional chemotherapy and involved node radiation. And then those randomized to the experimental arm, based on the PET results, it would dictate their therapy. So those that were PET negative received only additional chemotherapy, no radiation. And those that were PET positive received a more intensified therapy known as escalated Biocop with involved node radiation treatment. Both the UK RAPID and EORTC studies were designed as non-inferiority studies. These studies included both favorable and unfavorable patients, as you can see here. With the UK RAPID, about 2/3 were considered favorable, and then EORTC, as I mentioned, stratified patients based on favorable versus unfavorable. In both studies, non-inferiority could not be met. There was actually a significantly worse progression-free survival with omission of radiation, and currently there's no evidence that radiation can be safely omitted, even with a negative PET CT. Our medical oncology colleagues have been also using this response-adapted therapy for chemotherapy alone strategies. So the RATHEL study technically is a study among advanced stage Hodgkin's lymphoma, includes stage 2B to 4, but of note, 40% were stage 2 in the study, 1/3 had bulky disease, and radiation was not recommended for patients that had a negative interim PET. So in this study, patients received 2 cycles of ABVD and then had a PET. If they were positive, they actually got more intensified therapy with Biocop. If they were negative, then they were randomized to omission of bleomycin for the last 4 cycles or the standard of ABVD for 4 more cycles. And as you can see here on the lower right, in terms of the progression-free survival, omission of bleomycin was associated with a slight decrease in progression-free survival and technically didn't meet the non-inferiority margin. You can see that the upper bounds of the 95% confidence interval exceeds the pre-specified non-inferiority margin of 5%. And then of note, not shown here on this graph, but the progression-free survival for PET2 positive patients and that received Biocop, and about 10% of these patients actually received radiation, the progression-free survival was significantly worse compared to those that were PET negative. So it was 67.5%. So in summary, for early stage Hodgkin lymphoma, for those that have favorable disease, the combined modality approach will give you the best outcomes. A chemotherapy alone approach can be considered, though I always counsel patients to expect a lower progression-free survival by about 5-7%. And then as I reiterate to our residents, if you're going to be choosing the least intensive therapy, which is 2 cycles of APVD and 20 gray of radiation, you need to make sure that your patient fits the criteria for the German Hodgkin study group definition of favorable. And then for early stage unfavorable, very similar. Combined modality approach has the best outcomes. Chemotherapy alone is not wrong, though it does require counseling patients that omission of radiation will likely decrease progression-free survival by about 7-10% if there's disease bulk, and otherwise 5-7%. And then patients that have a end of chemotherapy positive PET or interim PET that is positive do worse, and so does raise the consideration of intensifying treatment. So we'll now transition from early stage to advanced stage Hodgkin's lymphoma. What are the indications for radiation for these patients? Well, the role of radiation for residual disease has been well established. In the German Hodgkin study group HD12, they randomized patients who had residual disease on a CAT scan greater than or equal to 1.5 centimeters or initial bulk after Biocop chemotherapy to 30 gray versus no further treatment. And on the right here, you can see that there's an improvement in progression-free survival with the addition of radiation for bulk or residual disease. And on a subset analysis for just those patients with residual disease, there was a statistically significant benefit in terms of PFS. The HD15 study takes this one step further. They incorporate PET as part of deciding whether patients should receive radiation or not. This is non-randomized, but all patients that had PET positive disease and greater than or equal to 2.5 centimeters residual after Biocop received 30 gray, if patients were PET negative, they did not receive any radiation. So with this strategy, those patients that were PET positive had a slightly lower progression-free survival, 86% versus 92% for those that were PET negative. And though this PFS rate is a little bit lower, it's still considered very good. Just to give context, in the RATHL study, which we just discussed, the 3-year progression-free survival for those patients that were PET positive was only 67%, and only about 10% of these patients received radiation, in contrast to all patients with PET positive disease in the HD15 receiving radiation. So altogether, these studies suggest that there is a role of radiation to improve progression-free survival for patients with metabolically active disease after treatment for advanced stage Hodgkin's lymphoma. In contrast, I think that the data regarding the role of radiation for initial bulk and advanced stage is a little bit more murky. There have been 2 studies from the Italian Lymphoma Foundation, one in abstract form, evaluating the role of radiation after a complete metabolic response for patients with initial bulk greater than or equal to 5 centimeters. So patients were randomized to radiation to 30 gray versus no further treatment. And in both studies, there's numerical but not statistically significant benefit of the addition of radiation in terms of progression-free survival. In summary, for patients with advanced stage Hodgkin's lymphoma, the backbone of treatment is chemotherapy. You should definitely consider adding on radiation if patients have a partial metabolic response, as this improves progression-free survival. But in patients with initial bulk that attain a complete metabolic response, there may be very minimal of any benefit of ISRT and should be considered only if you think that this could be administered safely. 10-20% of patients with early stage and 30-40% of patients with advanced stage Hodgkin's lymphoma will have relapse refractory disease. And there are defined adverse prognostic factors. So those patients with a short remission, less than 1 year, stage 3-4 at relapse and anemia have worse prognosis. In general, the treatment paradigm is to biopsy to confirm active disease and then taking these patients to salvage chemotherapy with consolidation autologous stem cell transplant, as stem cell transplant improves progression-free survival. Approximately 50% are cured after transplant. In a small minority of patients, so those with a late relapse that is isolated, localized, and asymptomatic, you may consider just a salvage chemotherapy approach plus or minus radiation with the omission of autologous stem cell transplant. The indications for radiation in the relapse refractory setting can include cytoreduction after an inadequate response to salvage chemotherapy or autologous stem cell transplant where you're treating gross disease, or in those patients that achieve a good response after systemic therapy, consolidating them given potential high risk of local recurrence, including those with primary chemorefractory disease or have metabolically active disease prior to stem cell transplant. The ILRAD guidelines shown here on the right also outline other considerations of radiation for these patients, including those with localized relapse or bulky disease, or sites where local control is very important. For patients that relapse after a stem cell transplant, the prognosis is generally poor. There is a series from Princess Margaret Hospital evaluating the potential role of radiation for these patients, and while the overall response rate is excellent, 80%, you can see here that the progression-free survival rate is rather low. At 2 years, is only 16%, and primarily driven by distant relapses. And of course, palliation can always be reserved for these patients in the relapse refractory setting. So I'll transition now from classical Hodgkin's to non-classical Hodgkin's lymphoma. So nodular lymphocyte predominant Hodgkin lymphoma is a distinct clinical and pathologic entity, which we discussed earlier. These only comprise 5% of Hodgkin's lymphoma and have an indolent course with a tendency for late relapses, which is in contrast to classical Hodgkin's lymphoma, where the predominance of relapses happen the first 2 to 3 years after treatment. 75% are male. They tend to present with more peripheral adenopathy, so of the axilla or groin, and with stage 1-2 disease, B symptoms are actually rare. And whereas the Reed-Sternberg cells are the neoplastic cells for classical Hodgkin's lymphoma, for NLPHL, this is the lymphocyte-predominant cell, which is actually CD20 positive. And this neoplastic cell, histologically and based on immunophenotype, actually has more similarity to T-cell histiocytic-rich B-cell lymphoma. These patients actually are at risk for transformation to diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. There's no randomized data on the optimal therapy for NLPHL. For stage 1A and contiguous stage 2A non-bulky, radiation alone would be considered standard. And though there's no chemotherapy given, though we're using smaller fields, there's no apparent increase in local regional recurrence. And this is data that's been borne out from the German Hodgkin Study Group and on the right that you can see here from MD Anderson, where you can look at the progression-free survival based on the radiation fields. Obviously, one caveat is I've told you that there are late relapses that can happen with NLPHL, so those treated with ISRT are going to have obviously shorter follow-up time. Nonetheless, the local control is excellent with radiation, with the predominance of relapses being distant. For patients with stage 1-2 with B symptoms or bulk or non-contiguous stage 2, chemotherapy with involved site radiation plus or minus rituximab can be considered. So we'll now transition from Hodgkin's lymphoma to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and this is a very basic kind of overview of how I think about non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So they're divided as B-cell lymphomas, which are more commonly seen in Western countries, versus T-cell lymphomas. And then within each of these, clinically how they behave, aggressive versus indolent. We'll review DLBCL, follicular lymphoma, and extranodal marginal zone lymphoma. So the role of radiation for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, similar to Hodgkin's lymphoma, spans both early stage and advanced stage disease, and then both in the upfront and relapse refractory setting. So I list here kind of the indications I consider for radiation. And similar to Hodgkin's lymphoma, contemporary trials evaluate the role of radiation in the PET era and now also for DLBCL, the rituximab era. To help frame the discussion on DLBCL, I'll review a case. So this is a 64-year-old female from the Ukraine with a history of thyroid nodules. She was noted over time to have change in her left thyroid nodule, which prompted a biopsy that was non-diagnostic. She actually underwent a repeat biopsy that also was non-diagnostic, and as such, underwent a PET CT, the results that you can see here on the right on her coronal image. So she only had one site of uptake, which correlated to that left thyroid nodule, which you can see on the fused axial PET CT slices, and corresponded to a hyperdense nodule on her diagnostic CAT scan. As such, she underwent a left thyroid lobectomy, which showed a small focus of DLBCL that was positive for CD20. This brings us to our third live SACME question. Which of the following is not considered an adverse pathologic feature among patients with large B-cell lymphoma? Back to our patient, her path was tested for cell of origin and was found to have a germinal center B-cell like subtype and underwent testing for MYC rearrangement, and this was negative based on FISH. Why do we do this? Well, there are pathologic features that have been shown to be prognostic and even predictive to certain therapeutics. So these include the cell of origin and the presence of MYC, BCL2, and or BCL6 translocations. So cell of origin was defined using gene expression profiling, which identified two subtypes, germinal center B cell-like, or GCB and non-GCB. And among patients that were treated with anthracycline-based chemotherapy, there was improved overall survival among those that had GCB versus non-GCB subtype. In clinical practice, this can be hard to do gene expression profiling since it requires fresh tissue, and there are immunohistochemical stains that can be used to approximate this, and one of the algorithms that is commonly used is the Hans algorithm. For presence of MYC, BCL2, and or BCL6 translocations, translocations of two or three of these genes is colloquially known as double or triple hit lymphoma. These patients, as you can see here, have a worse overall survival compared to non-double hit patients and has been recognized as such in the WHO 2016 classification of lymphoid neoplasms. So our fourth live SACME question is, according to the International Prognostic Index, or IPI, which of the following is considered a poor prognostic factor for patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma? So our patient here has now a resected DLBCL, GCB subtype, so that's favorable. She has a normal LDH and an excellent performance status. So these patients undergo risk stratification as per the International Prognostic Index, which is comprised of five clinical factors. So performance status, age greater than 60, elevated LDH, stage 3-4, and two or more extranodal sites. This patient had an IPI score of 1 because of her age. And you can see here on the right that this would put her in the low risk group or good risk group with a 4-year progression-free survival of 80 to 85%. So just of note, the standard IPI was the initial validation of the IPI, but this was done before rituximab was in routine use. And as rituximab does improve overall survival by 10 to 15%, they revalidated the IPI among patients that were treated with R-CHOP, which is what the revised IPI is. The standard of care for early stage non-bulky DLBCL was in part defined by the SWOG 8736 study. This is an older study, so it was before rituximab and PET, so there are certain limitations. But in this study, they randomized patients with stage 1, 2 aggressive non-Hodgkin's lymphoma with good prognosis, so 72% had an IPI score of 0 or 1, to either 8 cycles of CHOP or abbreviated CHOP, so 3 cycles, supplemented with involved field radiation to 40 to 55 gray. And with long-term follow-up, median follow-up of almost 18 years, there was no difference in progression or overall survival between these two arms. So we think about these two options as equivalent for early stage DLBCL. Of course, one of the major limitations of the SWOG study is that this was done before rituximab. So more recently, the LYSA-0203 study from France was published, evaluating the role of radiation in the rituximab era. So this included favorable patients, less than 7 centimeters stage 1, 2 DLBCL, and they were randomized up front to receive radiation versus none. The number of cycles of chemotherapy was based on what's called the stage-modified IPI. This is comprised of 4 risk factors, as you can see here in the second bullet. Patients that had none of these risk factors received 4 cycles of R-CHOP, and then if there were one or more of these risk factors involved, then they received 6 cycles of R-CHOP. If they had a partial response after 4 cycles of R-CHOP, all patients, regardless of their arm of randomization, then received 2 more cycles of R-CHOP plus radiation. So as I mentioned, it's a very favorable cohort. Over half had a stage-modified IPI score of 0, so no adverse factors, and one of the out of 5 had actually no gross disease before chemotherapy because of an excisional biopsy that removed all gross disease. 40% received more than 4 cycles of R-CHOP. This study was designed as a non-inferiority study. You can see that the event-free survival with radiation was similar to that of chemo alone, though they don't comment whether the non-inferiority margin was met. They also evaluated the event-free survival of patients that attained a complete response versus a partial response. And remember, all patients with the partial response received radiation. And the fact that these are very similar suggests that there's a role of radiation for patients with a partial response. Radiation definitely improved local control, so if you look at the patterns of relapse, among patients treated with chemo alone, 5 out of 13 relapsed in an initial site of disease, whereas none in the combined modality treatment relapsed in an irradiated site. So among Patients that have a complete response after 4 cycles of R-CHOP, the addition of radiation does not appear to impact event-free survival for patients with very favorable low-volume disease. There was no Deauville score to define PET positive versus negative, and the follow-up for the study is relatively short, only 5 years in comparison to the SWOG study, which is significant given that these patients can have very late relapses, so further follow-up is warranted. A ongoing study evaluating the role of radiation in the rituximab and PET era is the SWOG-1001. So this is a phase 2 PET-adapted treatment for patients with less than 10 centimeters stage 1 to DLBCL. It's non-randomized, but as you can see here, patients would receive 3 cycles of R-CHOP, and if PET is negative, they would receive only 1 more cycle, no radiation. In those patients that are PET positive, they get more intensified treatment, including local radiation treatment followed by radioimmunolabeled antibody. This is a CD20 antibody conjugated to yttrium-90, which has beta emission. So this study also has fairly favorable features. Over half have stage 1 disease, 65% with a IPI score of 0 or 1. So 11% actually have PET-positive disease after 3 cycles of R-CHOP, and among those, 2/3 were able to convert from a PR to a CR. And those patients that were PET-positive actually had similar progression-free survival compared to those patients that are PET-negative, suggesting a role of radiation as part of intensification. So for our patient, a 64-year-old female with stage 1 resected DLBCL of the thyroid, we actually recommended 3 cycles of R-CHOP followed by involved site radiation, as she otherwise would have required a full course of chemotherapy based on the LYSIS study. And the consideration of giving full course chemotherapy for older patients is a point of discussion. Based on data from Serum Medicare and a retrospective series from MD Anderson, there appears that combined modality treatment and full course chemotherapy are roughly equivalent in terms of efficacy, and maybe combined modality treatment may be even more efficacious. If you look here on the lower right and look at the probability of freedom from second line therapy, i.e. salvage therapy, this risk is lower for combined modality treatment. And then on the flip side, besides just efficacy, in terms of toxicity rates, this has shown to be more favorably, combined modality treatment has been more favorably tolerated both in terms of hematologic and neuropathy, and also has lower anthracycline exposure. So what is the dose that we should consider for aggressive non-Hodgkin's lymphoma? Well, this has been nicely defined by the UK BNLI study. This study stratified patients based on indolent versus aggressive non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Among those with aggressive non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, they randomized them to the standard arm of 40 to 45 gray versus the experimental arm of 30 gray. The primary endpoint was overall response rate, which you can see here was very similar between the two and over 90%, and there was no difference in freedom from local progression between the high and low dose arms. So this study demonstrates that we can safely de-escalate treatment to 30 gray for aggressive non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, though there are several caveats, including that this was a heterogeneous group, including some patients treated with radiation alone. There was no chemotherapy data or functional imaging provided. So in summary, for limited stage DLBCL, the role of radiation actually is to allow minimization of systemic therapy. That is, that we're replacing additional cycles of chemotherapy with radiation instead. We know that this strategy of abbreviated R-CHOP plus radiation is equivalent to a full course of R-CHOP, and in older patients may be better tolerated. Though in those patients with low volume, very favorable disease, a chemo alone approach may be adequate after a complete metabolic response. We'll now be transitioning from early stage to advanced stage DLBCL. So for this fourth case, this is a 51-year-old female with prolonged healing after dental work. A CT scan showed an 8.3-centimeter tumor of the right masticator space, and biopsy showed DLBCL, GCB subtype, and negative for MYC rearrangement. On PET CT, she had additional sites of involvement and was found to have stage 4 disease, but with bulky involvement of the right masticator space, and was treated with a full course of chemotherapy followed by consolidation radiation to her initial site of bulk. The role of radiation for older patients with bulk has been established by this prospective but non-randomized RECOVER-60 study. The initial RECOVER-60 is actually a clinical trial asking chemotherapy questions, but all patients on that trial were recommended to receive radiation to sites of initial bulk defined as greater than or equal to 7.5 centimeters. Then what they did is they took the best arm of this Recover 60 and compared it to the same arm but now without radiation. Though of note, nearly one quarter of patients with bulky disease received unplanned radiation in this Recover no RT arm. So as such, they analyzed this as a per protocol analysis, and the addition of radiation improved both progression-free and overall survival, as you can see here. Can PET be used to identify which patients require radiation for bulk? Well, there is preliminary abstract-only data from the Optimal 60 study. This is in patients greater than 60. The actual clinical trial is a 2x2 randomized trial asking chemotherapy questions, but as part of that trial, patients with bulk, defined as greater than or equal to 7.5 centimeters, were to get radiation only if they had residual metabolic activity after 6 cycles of chemotherapy. Otherwise, they were observed. So approximately 1/3 of patients had bulky disease. About 50% of these patients had persistent metabolic activity after 6 cycles of chemotherapy, and 78% received radiation. So as part of the study, what they did was they compared these patients on the bulky optimal study, so it was a PET-adapted approach of who received radiation for bulk, and compared it to the Recover 60 patients in which all patients received radiation. And you can see that the 2-year progression-free survival is very similar. So it's preliminary but non-randomized data suggesting that PET may be able to select patients with disease bulk that can be spared radiation. The role of radiation for bulk in younger patients, so less than 60 years of age, has also been investigated. The Danish Unfolder study has only been presented in abstract form. It includes patients with good prognosis. You can see here that they had to have an age-modified IPA score of 0 to 1 and had a 2x2 factorial design. The first randomization with giving R-CHOP every 14 versus 21 days, and then in patients with bulk and or extranodal disease, plus or minus radiation. The no radiation arms actually were closed based on an interim analysis, given higher events, primarily higher partial response requiring additional treatment. So it's hard, the studies may not be able to help us, at least right now in abstract form, to determine who can do well without radiation. There's been a study published from the Mexico National Medical Center. It's a slightly different cohort. So this includes stage 3-4 DLBCL. Bulk here is defined as greater than 10 centimeters, and these patients had higher adverse features with an IPI of 3 to 4. And these patients, after 6 cycles of R-CHOP, if they attained a complete response based on CT, were then randomized to 30 gray radiation versus observation. And in this study, the addition of radiation improved local recurrence, progression-free, and overall survival. Radiation also has a role for patients with skeletal involvement. This is non-randomized data, but they reanalyzed 9 Danish trials. The first take home is that bone involvement, so this is not bone marrow, but more focal involvement, is fairly rare, less than 10%. And then radiation for bone involvement was recommended in the trials but not mandated. And so they can compare the event-free survival of those patients that had bone involvement that received radiation and did not. And you can see here an improvement in event-free survival. So in summary, for advanced diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, the goal of radiation is actually not to substitute for but supplement a full course of chemotherapy for patients that have additional risk factors. So these include bulk, skeletal involvement, and a partial response to initial therapy, and maybe in the future there may be other biomarkers as well. So for relapse refractory DLBCL, these patients have a similar paradigm like Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is to undergo salvage chemotherapy and stem cell transplant. And the benefit of this has been demonstrated on the PARMA trial, where transplant was associated with improved overall survival compared to just conventional treatment. Of note, in this trial, patients with bulk, so greater than 5 centimeters at relapse, also received radiation. Unfortunately, though, in contrast to patients with Hodgkin's lymphoma, only a smaller proportion make it to transplant. So only 50% end up being eligible for transplant. And then among those, only 50% have chemosensitive disease. So about only 1/4 make it to transplant. The indications for radiation in the relapse refractory setting are listed here. Some of these include are kind of extrapolated from the upfront setting, such as skeletal involvement or incomplete response to salvage chemotherapy or stem cell transplant. In terms of dose, the dose considered does vary based on indications. Strategies I like to highlight is that if you're trying to finish treatment quickly because you're trying to take them to stem cell transplant, or if this is rapidly growing, you could consider a hyperfractionated BID approach. And then in patients that are not transplant candidates, but you're still trying to aim for cure, especially with radiation alone, it's important to highlight that relapse refractory DLBCL is more radioresistant compared to Hodgkin's lymphoma, and you do have to go to quite high doses, upwards of 45 to 55 gray, in attempts to kind of get more durable local control. Besides transplant, relapse refractory DLBCL patients now have access to other novel therapies, including chimeric antigen receptor or CAR T-cells. So this is a form of cellular immunotherapy where the goal is to remove barriers for the immune system to eradicate cancer cells. So the patients undergo leukapheresis, and the lymphocytes are extracted, modified, and reinfused back into the patient. And what is modified is shown here, which is this membrane receptor targeting specific antigen. There's two components associated. The extracellular component is charged with recognizing the cancer cell target antigen, and in this case, it's CD19. And then there is a transmembrane and intracellular component whose goal is to signal to activate the T cell. There have been two products approved in the relapse refractory setting, T-cell and axi-cell. So how does radiation interface with CAR T cells? Well, I mentioned to you that there can be a delay as a median of 17 to 39 days actually between leukapheresis and when the T cells are ready for reinfusion. So radiation can help with symptom control and preserve performance status as you are bridging patients to the systemic therapy. However, we don't know what the optimal dose fractionation and targets are, but generally I've been cytoreducing symptomatic and or bulky disease, and the dose fractionation tends to be more hypofractionated because you have more limited time before the patients are undergo infusion. Generally, we try to hold off on starting radiation, especially if it's to the pelvic region, until patients have undergone leukapheresis. And preliminary data suggests that we're not necessarily decreasing CAR T cell efficacy, maybe even helping to decrease CAR T cell toxicity. So we're going to transition now to indolent non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And so for follicular lymphoma, about 15 to 30% have localized disease. And for those that have stage 1 and contiguous stage 2, they would be eligible for curative intent radiation with ISRT. Chemoimmunotherapy could also be considered for these patients based on a recently published trial from Australia, the TROG-9903. I won't go over the data, though the slides are available here for your reference, suggesting improvement in progression-free survival, but no difference yet seen with overall survival. For non-contiguous stage 2 follicular lymphoma, chemoimmunotherapy plus or minus ISRT or observation can be considered. And then in the advanced stage or relapse refractory, these are considered incurable patients. There are indications to consider systemic therapy, otherwise observation is preferred. But of course, we should not forget that we can consider palliative radiation 2 gray times 2 with excellent response rates. So this brings us to our last live SACME question. What is the rate of response, complete and partial, to low-dose radiotherapy 4 gray 2 fractions for follicular lymphoma? So for patients with localized follicular lymphoma, PET CT is the standard of care, and as PET actually alters management in about 45% of patients. In 30% of patients, these are upstaged from stage 1, 2 to 3, 4, where the role of radiation is not going to be curative. And then in 15%, patients are upstaged from stage 1 to 2, where it would affect what fields you are going to be treating. Even though patients undergo staging PET CT, a bone marrow biopsy should be obtained. And then in terms of pathology, important to pay attention to the grade of the follicular lymphoma. Grade 1 to 2 is considered indolent. In contrast, grade 3B is actually treated more like DLBCL. And then grade 3A, it's controversial. Some may treat it as grade 1, 2, while others may treat it as more grade 3B. The outcomes of radiation alone for localized follicular lymphoma, especially with modern staging, is excellent. So this is a multi-institution retrospective study in which all patients had undergone a PET CT and nearly all with a bone marrow biopsy. They were treated with a median dose of 30 gray for stage 1-2 follicular lymphoma, including grades 1 to 3A. 80% had stage 1 disease. The local control was excellent, so almost 98%. You can see there was a very small proportion that had an infield or marginal relapse. The predominance of failure was distant. And then patients with stage 1 disease had a higher freedom from progression compared to those with stage 2, 74 versus 49%. And these are much higher than historical controls and reflect the impact of modern staging, namely stage migration, and also highlights that maybe we've been underestimating the curative potential of radiation for truly localized disease. 24 gray is the standard of care for follicular lymphoma in the definitive setting, and this has been defined based on the UK BNLA randomized study. So we're going back now to the second half of the study, which looked at indolent non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and randomized these patients to the standard at that time, which was 40 to 45 gray versus 24 and 12. And 24 was considered non-inferior, no difference in overall response rate, freedom from local progression or progression-free survival. Can we go lower than 24 gray? Well, the Fort non-inferiority randomized trial tried to evaluate this, comparing 24 to 4 gray, and found that the time to local progression, which you can see here on the upper right, was shorter for those patients treated with 4 versus 24 gray, and that was the primary endpoint. If you look at the overall response rates with the 4 gray arm, the overall response rate was about 80% and lower comparatively to the 24 gray arm of 91%. There was also a little bit lower complete response rates with 4 versus 24 gray. Regardless, I think this still highlights that 4 gray is a very useful alternative for patients in the palliative setting. And this is the TROG-9903 study that I mentioned earlier regarding the potential role of chemotherapy to improve progression-free survival for localized follicular lymphoma. So what does ISRT look like for patients treated with radiation alone? This is a patient of mine with grade 1 to 2 follicular lymphoma of the right groin. The GTV is outlined here in green, and then the CTV in orange. So I use the I used anatomic borders to define my inguinal lymph nodes, in which you can see that the CTV should incorporate the GTV and, as a minimum, adjacent lymph nodes in that site and a generous margin dictated by the clinical situation. So in this case, because no chemotherapy is given, you can see here on the lower panel that I did treat kind of above and below where the GTV is to potentially capture subclinical disease. We'll talk about the other commonly seen indolent non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, so marginal zone lymphoma. There are three subtypes: extranodal marginal zone lymphoma, or MALT lymphoma, nodal, and then splenic marginal zone lymphoma. MALT lymphomas can comprise about 50% of lymphomas at certain sites, so classically stomach, orbit, or lung, but can also affect other sites including breasts, salivary glands, Waldeyer's ring, and thyroid, and 60-70% of patients present with stage 1 to 2 disease. Gastric MALT has a little bit more unique of a workup. So this includes endoscopy with adequate biopsies and then testing for H. pylori. If patients are H. pylori positive, generally you would like to also test for translocation 11-18, as this has been associated with higher rates of relapse or lower rates of response to antibiotics. MALT lymphomas are not always uniformly FDG avid, so the diagnostic imaging will be a CT scan plus or minus a PET. So for patients with stage 1, 2 disease that are H. pylori positive, generally a trial of antibiotic therapy is given in order to eradicate the H. pylori infection, and 80% of the time this is also associated with the complete response of the MALT, though the time to complete response can be slow. ISRT then is used for salvage. In patients that are H. pylori negative or are H. pylori positive but with the translocation 11-18, generally ISRT is considered upfront with very high rates of response and freedom from progression, and then rituximab only if radiation is contraindicated. Radiation treatment planning for gastric MALT usually involves patients being NPO about 4 hours prior, and as the stomach can move with respiration, consideration of 4D CT scan for motion management with a small volume of barium. I generally simulate these patients with arms up. And so for this patient, who was incidentally noted to have gastric MALT that was H. pylori negative. I treated her with a 3-day conformal, so a 4-field plan, 30 gray and 20 fractions with daily ondansetron pretreatment with the PPI. And the target, the CTV-ITV, includes the entire stomach, including the gastroduodenal junction. Besides 3D conformal, other techniques can be considered, including IMRT VMAT, which may have better sparing of the kidneys, and then consideration of deep inspiration breath hold. As you can see here on these coronal images, with that deep inspiration, this may increase the distance between the heart and the upper abdomen, and in dosimetric comparative studies has been associated with lower mean heart, lung, and liver dose compared to free breathing. And then in order to assess the reproducibility of the stomach, daily cone beam CT may be helpful. In terms of the radiation dose, 24 to 30 gray in 1.5 to 2 gray fractions is reasonable. This is a phase 2 randomized study from France, the Helix 2, comparing 36 gray with 25.2 gray and 1.8 gray fraction, showing no difference in complete response or risk of recurrence. For MALT of non-gastric sites, I'm going to refer you to the ILROG consensus guidelines. And just of note, here and across the rest of the slides, I've highlighted these guidelines in orange and have placed one slide at the very end summarizing all the guidelines published to date by the ILROG. So in summary, modern radiation therapy for lymphoma aims to maintain excellent disease control while minimizing late toxicity. And this is through a 3-prong approach of using smaller fields and 3D treatment planning, which is encapsulated with the ISRT-INRT concept, and using lower doses. Many de-escalation protocols, including those calling for radiation omission, use a PET-adapted approach, but I hope I've impressed upon you that radiation cannot be safely omitted for Hodgkin's lymphoma, even with a complete metabolic response to chemotherapy, and there's ongoing studies for DLBCL. And then for patients with localized indolent non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, radiation remains the cornerstone of treatment, and as our diagnostic imaging and workup improves, we're going to be able to better select those who benefit from local therapy. Thank you for your attention.